Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Beckhoff has written and recorded more than 30 books, and clearly he doesn't plan to stop writing anytime soon. Indeed, part of the reason he's joining me on the show today is to discuss his new book, Love in Their Hearts, A Celebration of Animal Emotions and a Guide to Compassionate Action, co-written by Jeff Campbell and featuring a foreword by the late Jane Goodall. With a style and tone that will likely appeal to younger readers while delivering science-based information and anecdotes that should delight and fascinate an adult audience, Beckhoff and Campbell string together any number of examples of non-human animals exhibiting playfulness, empathy, grief, curiosity, love, and other emotions that may surprise readers of various ages, I suppose. Beckhoff has won many awards for his research on animal behavior, animal emotions, cognitive ethology, compassionate conservation, and animal protection, including the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society. He's co-chair of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute and is a former Guggenheim Fellow. We'll discuss the new book and more when I speak with Dr. Mark Beckhoff here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll speak with Sarah Richardson of the James Museum about Menagerie at the Museum, a special event happening at the James this Saturday, August 15th, providing access to an assortment of live animals and representatives from several of Pinellas County Animal Rescue and Wildlife Conservation Organizations, plus an opportunity to see the special exhibit about wolves by photographer Ronan Donovan that we highlighted on the show in early May, and more than that as well. We're about Menagerie at the Museum and the James Museum later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into the conversation with Dr. Mark Beckhoff about his new book, Love in Their Hearts, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Mark Beckhoff to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Duncan. Thanks for having me, and hello, everybody who's listening.
Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on the new book, which I look forward to discussing with you in a moment or two. First, though, as I noted in the introduction, Jane Goodall wrote the foreword, and you're involved with the Jane Goodall Foundation. She was such a towering figure. I'd love to hear your observations and some experiences about her.
Yeah, well, Jane was a very close friend, colleague, and we both shared a love for P.T. Scotch, which she called her cough medicine. I worked with Jane on other books. We wrote a book called The Ten Trusts that was published in 2002, and we worked on a whole lot of different projects. And in fact, we have a young kids book coming out in February 2027 called Every Elephant Has a Name. So, you know, in addition to being an ambassador for hope and peace and compassion and love, Jane also was a crack scientist. Her book called The Chimpanzees of Gombe that was published in 1986 is still the standard for field work on great apes and other animals. So people sometimes forget that she had a PhD from Cambridge University in the UK. And we gave Jane a book for her birthday called Jane Goodall at 90, which presents what we call the real Jane. She had a great sense of humor and had a very light side. And sometimes she lamented that people didn't know that she had that great sense of humor. But anyway, I value the many years we were close colleagues. We traveled all over the world. And I really am looking forward to our young kids book coming out in February 2027.
Well, that sounds great. And since you note that she kind of wished more people realized there was that lighter side to her, I guess I'm curious, given your long association with her, if there's something you can share, an anecdote or detail about her that we might all find surprising, on reflecting that lighter side or some other aspect.
Yeah, I mean, one was, of course, her love for Scotch. That became very apparent because the New York Times ran an article about her life, and they actually had Scotch in the title of it. But yeah, something, like I said before, that people, I think they knew, but they didn't really realize, was how good of a scientist she was. So working closely with her, some people would say, oh, you know, she's so busy, she's traveling all over the world. And I was too for a while. And, you know, how much does she really put into these projects? So the Forward for Love in Their Hearts is a good example, as is our kids' book that's forthcoming. We worked hard. She didn't just slap her name on things. In fact, there were things, not for me, thank goodness, but others where she just chose not to put her name on because she didn't have the time to do the rigorous editing, if you will.
Yeah.
So the Forward for Love in Their Hearts went through a lot of iterations, and the text for our young forthcoming kids book went through a lot of edits, and we finally got to the point where if she was traveling and I was traveling, I would send her the text that I liked in blue and the text that I didn't like in red, and the text on which I was kind of ambivalent in green. And often her emails were blue, love Jane from Europe, South Africa, or wherever she was.
Mm-hmm.
But really hard worker. And her loss was extremely unexpected. I had been in contact with her not long before. And we finished the text for the kids' book last summer. But the day before she passed, I sent her some of the preliminary artwork, and she never got to see it. So that was sad.
Yeah.
But all in all, good friend, good colleague, and a lovely woman.
For sure. And one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading the book and read the foreword, of course, and the book is dedicated to Jane as well, is that, you know, like you noted earlier, some people kind of overlook the fact that she had a PhD, she was a serious scientist. But even beyond that, I got thinking recently, and having interviewed her a couple times and thinking about her in those times, that she also was tremendously gifted as a scientist. I mean, she didn't just have a PhD in the training and the rigor that goes with that. There was something extra special about her. But when you think about that, the research from Gombe still stands as hugely significant all these years later, that says a lot more about someone than just that they have a PhD.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, as late as last year, she was going back to Gombe and walking through what was left of the forest, of course, because, you know, when she got there, it was heavily treed, heavily forested. And some of the pictures now of the Gombe Research Station in Tanzania, show no trees. But she had a knack for observation, and it was a very keen knack, because we spent some time looking at some animals years ago, and, you know, she just had a keen eye, and she really had this ability to get into their heads and hearts, if you will. And that was one of the landmarks of her research when she started. You know, she named the animals, she talked about individual personalities. She had the F family of, you know, Feigen, Flo, and other animals. And she was told by people or her mentors at Cambridge that, you know, quote, we don't name animals or talk about personalities. Clearly she did. And that had a marked effect on my graduate training, because she had already been in the field for about a decade when I started doing this work. And her husband at the time, Hugo von Leeuwenhoek, the famous National Geographic photographer, used to stay with me when he was in the States. So I had like a sneak preview of what Jane was doing before she just started publishing her work. But she was a keen field ethologist, and that's how she prefers to be thought of these days.
Yeah. Well, one last thing before we move on to other things, sure, including the book, obviously, et cetera. But did you ever join her in her nightly ritual, a swig of whiskey?
Yeah.
Something tells me you did.
Yeah, when we traveled, we shared whiskey. I mean, you know, we weren't lushes, but it was lovely to end a long day. And when we did our Zooms, I often did them. I live in Boulder, Colorado, and so there was about a 7-hour difference, depending where she was, but if she were home in the UK. And so we would do them at maybe 2 or 3 my time and 9 or 10 at night her time. And the night that we gave her the surprise birthday book, Jane Goodall at 90, it was the day before New Year's, December 31st, 2023, because she turned 90 in 2024. We wanted the book to be a surprise. We have 90 original essays in there. And we were starting to get wind that somebody was going to blow the secret. So we did a Zoom. And it was noon here and 7 there. And we all toasted at the end. And I thought I could fool her and the other 3 people on the Zoom by lifting an empty glass. And she said, "Mark, your glass is empty." So often when I did my Zooms with her at noon or 3 in the afternoon in Boulder, Colorado, it would just be a nap afterwards. It was like, I once said, "Jane, I can't do this." And she said, "Well, we've got a toast." And I said, "Well, Jane, you're going to sleep and I've got like the rest of the day." But over those toasts too, just to be honest, like when we were writing the 10 Trusts, I think it was in the year 2001, Jane and Mary Lewis, who was her, still is basically her executive assistant, shared a home for about 5 days. They gave us a house where we were. So at night we would, you know, maybe have a shot of scotch and talk science. And both our mothers were important in our lives. And that was another shared, you know, aspect of my relationship with her. My mom was very important to me. She was somewhat of an empath. And everyone knows that when Jane first went to Gombe in 1960, she couldn't go alone. It wouldn't have been safe. So her mom went, and her mom sort of became the camp physician taking care of the locals. So there was a lot of overlap in our early lives and our later lives as scientists.
Yeah. Well, I always thought it was, you know, that the whole ritual was fascinating. We did talk about it on at least one of the interviews that we did on the show. And I kind of had the secret hope that somehow I'd be somewhere where I could enjoy a shot of scotch with Jane Goodall. But that didn't quite work out. But thank you.
Well, if you ever come to Boulder, I will be more than glad to share one with you.
Yeah, because that's the thing. She made it clear that she was toasting her mom and other people that had come and gone in her life, and wasn't just knocking back a shot. It was, had, you know, some significance, symbolic, and other kind of importance each night when she did do it.
Yeah, it was a really good way to end the day because, like I said, I've traveled with her in a lot of different countries, and the days were really long. And, you know, maybe at 8 or 9 at night local time, it would just be a time when we could just kick back and chat about the day and, you know, just often have personal stories about our moms and other things that were going on in her life.
Yeah.
But the discussions about the books, including the Foreword for Love in Their Hearts, they were really detailed. I mean, I make that point just because she had the energy of a 15-year-old when she was 90, and people were incredulous that she was back to traveling 300 or more days a year after COVID, when she, you know, because she was stuck at home for a really long time. So, yes, she was a remarkable woman, and I miss her dearly.
I'm sure. Well, for people who may have just tuned in a bit late, you know, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Beckhoff has written or co-written more than 30 books. His new book, co-written with Jeff Campbell, is Love in Their Hearts, A Celebration of Animal Emotions and a Guide to Compassion and Action. If you'd like to ask Dr. Beckhoff a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. All right, so let's talk about books, your books. So you've written or co-written, as I just mentioned, 30-some-odd books, and arguably more. I guess there's different ways to count them up, so there could be even a much larger total. But I'd be curious to know, what goes into deciding at this point you're going to tackle writing yet another book?
Well, you mean a new book?
Yeah, like in other words, like you've written so many, you're like,
right.
How do you say, okay, yeah, this, yeah, I'm ready to do this, or because this topic is so compelling, or you know, whatever criteria there is, I'd just be curious to know that, given that grand tally, you know, when you say, okay, I'm going to do one more now.
Yeah, it's a great question. I really enjoy writing books, and then I go through the stage, do I really want to? People have no idea how much time goes into writing a book, and I thought I was going to write a book called Why I Don't Want to Write Another Book. But but on the serious
limited
side...
Limited interest in that, probably, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
small readership, yeah.
Small readership, but I've been doing what I'm doing for a really long time, and I feel blessed to have had a major role, and also just sort of as, the old proverbial fly on the wall, the evolution, if you will, of the acceptance of animal sentience and animal emotions over the years. So in all honesty, I'm pretty knee-deep or neck-deep in a new book, not so much an autobiography about me, but an autobiography by concepts, many of which are raised in love in their hearts, of how it came to be. Because for a really long time, animals lost their minds. Behaviorism, a la B.F. Skinner, was kind of the talk of the day. Animals were stimulus response machines. They didn't have thoughts. They didn't have emotions. They were really just reflexive beings. But over the years, and I was really fortunate to be there right from the beginning in the mid-70s, when a man named Donald Griffin wrote a book, The Question of Animal Awareness. And Don had been an award-winning scientist and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. For me, and obviously for Jane, it was just clear. Animals had rich and deep emotional lives. I grew up on the streets of Brooklyn, New York, and I had my little tricycle, which was my field vehicle. And I would tell my folks, like Jane told her mom, I feel their emotions. So I would talk to the dogs and cats and mice and rats and birds. And I think some people thought I was a whack job back then, but my parents really supported me. So that's the basis of the new book. I've done a lot of field work. I've always been interested in animal well-being and what people call animal ethics. And that would be, learning about the lives of animals, their emotions, their intelligence, their social behavior, without intruding in their lives and having a negative influence on their behavior. But for your audience, one of the upshots of that is that a lot of intrusive research misrepresents the animals because they're stressed. And this is something Jane and I talked about a lot over the years.
So the research itself is changing the outcome of what they're researching in a sense.
Because
the impact on the animal.
Exactly, and there's evidence for it across the board. So I'm not trying to say that the research was poor or that the researchers had ill intentions, but what I am going to say is that it had an effect on their behavior. And so from day one, I would just be very careful that I did an 8.5-year field study of coyotes living in the Grand Teton National Park. So we habituated them to our presence. We painted all the field equipment a dull black. And we got a good feel for how they behaved before we were there, to be sure we weren't changing their behavior. And that's kind of the basis of the book I'm writing now, is seeing how animals lost their minds and how they regained them. I published a new and very much updated edition of my book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, in 2024. The original book was published in 2007, and I added about 300 references, and it's not just, The Emotional Lives of Animals 2007 updated. It's a completely new book. The reason I say that is because of all the references I added, a lot dealt with ethics and field work, and a lot dealt with basically non-invasive research, looking at how we could learn about the animals by not interfering in their lives. And not a single reference that I added said that we were doing all we could to increase their well-being, if you will, and increase, the quality of their lives. But what is happening now, and I know most of your listeners won't know this, is The United States Federal Welfare Act was rewritten in 2002, and there's a clause in there that basically says we're redefining the word animal to exclude rats and mice and birds and fish and other animals. And just to think about that, I mean, these animals are clearly animals. So outcome of life, love in their hearts, would be we talk a lot about these animals because they are animals, and people are incredulous to know that because rats and mice and other animals are not considered to be animals under the Federal Animal Welfare Act, they can be abused greatly in all sorts of research.
Oh, jeez. It looks like we have a caller here, so we might get them involved in the conversation.
Oh, okay. No, that's so. Okay. But you know, the upshot of the new book is, you know, like you said, it's written for a young adult audience. The teachers and parents and other adults who have read it have really liked it. And at the end of each chapter, there's a get started and sort of what you can do section, because compassion in action.
Yeah, no, I really planned to ask you about that, but let's get that caller on the conversation as well. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Mark Bickoff.
Hi. I'm calling because I've been a huge, huge fan of both you and Jane Goodall since I was very young. And I've been vegan for 13 years now, and I'm just wondering if you promote veganism as far as being the most compassionate way to be around, to be as far as animals go.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. I've been vegan for a really long time. And Jane became totally vegan about 10 years ago, although the only things, you know, the only foods she ate before were maybe a bite of cheese or an egg, never animal meat products, for example. Yeah, I do, but I try to do it in a reasonable way because I don't think that I or anybody should be militant about, I like to say who we eat, not what we eat. And so, yes, we do. And it's incredible how many youngsters.
I just want to interrupt real quick. I'm really sorry. I just wanted to say something about being militant. I really don't know why we say militant, because most vegans are very passionate about how they feel about animals. I don't feel like it's like we're like an army.
Oh, I don't. No. I totally agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. But there are some people who I know, and maybe you know, who are extremely abrupt and you should do this and you must do this. And I don't think personally that that's the way to get people to change their food habits or the way in which they relate to non-human animals. So compassion can go a long way by trying to understand why they do what they do and explain to them why you and I would prefer that they change their habits. But I totally agree with you that the vegan ethic is a broad ethic that is not only about meal plans. And we write about that in Love in Their Hearts, and I write about that in many other places, that a vegan ethic is really an ethic of peace and compassion. So thank you for saying that.
Thanks so much for your call. We're going to move along, but thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that was good.
Thanks.
So I want to go back a little bit, and then I want to move forward to get more into the book. But one of the things, as you were describing more about the book sort of and things that connect to it over your history, when you talked about the idea back in the day, at least, of research being intrusive and therefore affecting the actual research itself by virtue of being intrusive, I'm curious to know if all the cautions and precautions and protections, I guess, you put into your 8.5-year field study of coyotes to avoid those problems influenced other researchers who said, okay, so this is how it can be done without being intrusive in a way that does affect the outcome, and maybe this is some measures that we should adapt in our next research project ourselves.
Yes, it did. It had a large effect because, you know, lab research in a sense is intrusive in and of itself if you've got captive animals. And, you know, there are good studies from, you know, people who are looking at questions about animal behavior in general or animal emotions in captivity. But a captive life is a constrained life. So I do think that over the years, a lot of people have adapted their field methods so they don't stress the animals. And there's a woman called Gisela Kaplan in Australia who has written a lot about invasive field research, being against it, especially in birds, you know, showing how a lot of the field methods change the behavior of the birds, and it reduces the quality of the data. But I think right now, and there's a new field, well, it's about 15, 16 years old, called compassionate conservation, which really stresses the fact that when we go into the field to study animals, we really need to take into account their lifestyle, what they need and they want. And part of that is not to do invasive field work and not to kill animals in the name of conservation. It's a hugely popular field around the world, although traditional conservationists don't embrace it like I and some of my colleagues do. But I think over the years, we've seen a slow change in field methodology, honoring who the animals are who we're studying.
All right, well, let's talk about a few randomly, maybe even the emotions that are illuminated in the book. So playfulness, let's just start there, because that's, I think, simple and commonly understood, easy to make that case. We can all think of playful, joyful animals, whether it's the nutty puppy in the next room or the video clip of the black bear bursting into someone's backyard and throwing around the ball they found there. But what you're talking about in the book goes well beyond that. So there's lion cubs and there's giraffes and specific bird species and even bees. So talk about more of these. Let's say zebras and bees, you know, how they figure into the playful element of the book.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's, as far as I can see, there's no studies that have been done on mammals in which play has not been reported. I mean, some people think that some animals are more playful than others, like domestic dogs who have a good life at home. But yeah, zebras play. I actually have seen zebras play in the wild. I've seen wild elephants play. And then you get to bees. And, you know, people think bees are dumb. I mean, bees are really smart. The field of insect sentience is perhaps the most rapidly and broadly growing field of research. I mean, they're invertebrates, they're highly social. There's been work that shows that bees can get depressed and can also feel good. And now there's evidence that bees play. So,
and can you talk for just a sec, just because for a lot of people listening, they might say, well, how is that noticed, or how is that observed, or what do they do, or someone, a scientist or someone else doing a study says, well, that's clearly a bee at play?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it would be doing an activity that looks to be frivolous, if you will. You know, they could be romping around. E.O. Wilson, who's a very famous entomologist, he wondered, he never said it was play, but he wondered whether when ants get together and sort of tap their antennae, whether it was a form of play. So play, generally defined, is, you know, is often looked at, well, it's an activity that has no real direct purpose, if you will. If you think about play in dogs, they're romping around here and there, they're having a good time, they're biting one another on the muzzle, they're, you know, faking left and faking and then going right and getting other dogs to chase them. So it seems to be a behavior that has no function. We know that that isn't true now. And I'm not a bee expert, but there was a paper not too long ago of bees, you know, liking to roll balls around. So, you know, that would be object play. There's no reason to think that maybe that isn't a form of bee play. Do bees chase one another in flight in a playful way? We don't know. but I don't think we should close the door on it. And getting back to the vertebrates, I mean, I wrote a paper about 40 years ago with a grad student on play in birds. And where I live in Colorado, one day I got home and I was out on my deck and I saw five crows obviously playing, in the sense they were chasing one another, they were dive bombing. And about 5 minutes later, I got an email from someone who literally lived five blocks north of me. And he didn't know where I lived, but he said, "I think you live downtown Boulder. I'm watching a group of birds and it looks like they're playing." So I emailed him right back and said, "I'm watching the same group of birds."
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. So, you know, once again, they're dive bombing, they're having a good time, they're getting exercise, they may be learning social skills. So once again, it looks like a behavior that's just fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's interesting because when I was reading that section of the book, and then I just out of the top of my head, can I name some animals that I don't think of as playful? And like I thought of a cobra and maybe a vulture, a bison. But then I thought, maybe I'm wrong about those, the way some of these things have turned out to be wrong about, like, the bees and other things. So are there animals that clearly, from the flip side of the section in your book, that are playful or turn out to be playful, are decidedly not playful, and that position remains firm?
I would be very careful. So, for example, there's some good observations. Gordon Burghardt is a very well-known herpetologist, has seen reptiles playing with a ball in a pool. So is that play? Well, if you saw a dog rolling a ball with their nose or something, you'd call it play. So once again, you know, my general view on science in general, if you will, is let's just keep the door open. So is there snake play? You know, I don't really know. I'm not a herpetologist, but I'll bet you there are examples that look like they are playing with one another. So your question is a good one, because one of the things we stress in Love in Their Hearts, and I stress it in other places, we shouldn't be anthropocentric and think that animals express their feelings only in ways that we do, because they see and hear and smell and sense the world in different ways. So maybe when snakes are wrapping their bodies around one another and it looks to just be frivolous and, you know, functionless, it's a form of play.
Yeah.
I you know, Duncan, that's a great question, because that's just been one of my major messages, and Jane's as well, that let's just not close the door by being narrowly speciesist, that we are the template against, you know, whom all other animals are judged. For years, mammalian play was written off, and that's part of the book I'm writing now. There were literally people who claim that dogs and other animals don't really play. And even now, 50 years later, I do not have an answer.
Seems to be some evidence to the contrary there, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for them, other than perhaps they themselves were not particularly playful beings, but I don't want to go into that. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody looks like they're not playful or sour if you're not playful and sour. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got
right.
you.
Yeah.
All right, so this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. His new book, co-written with Jeff Campbell, is Love in Their Hearts, A Celebration of Animal Emotion and a Guide to Compassionate Action. You're invited to join the conversation. Please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So again, sort of just semi-randomly, I'm just going to move on to some other emotions that you guys cover in the book. So among the reasons I've been a card-carrying elephant nut for many years is that they're emotionally sophisticated animals who exhibit grief when a fellow elephant dies, observing sort of funeral-like rituals, I guess you could say, to say goodbye and so on. So not surprisingly, elephants constitutes a major element of your chapter on grief, and pop up in other chapters as well about grief, depression, and sadness. So tell me what we know about elephants in this regard.
excuse me. Well, I can give you a firsthand account. When I went to Samburu Elephant Camp and Samburu Reserve in northern Kenya, I hung out with a man called Ian Douglas Hamilton, who recently passed away shortly after Jane. And Ian was kind of considered, if you will, the Jane Goodall of elephants. So we got in his Land Rover. We drove into the field. I had never seen a wild elephant. And there in front of us was a group of elephants who seemed to have wanderlust. Their tails were down, their heads were down, they were moping. They just seemed to be just walking around. And I could feel their emotion. I could feel their sadness and grief. So I said to Ian, did something happen here? I mean, even though I had never seen a group of wild elephants, I expected a little more activity. And Ian said, yes, the matriarch, who is the oldest or next, sort of the one of the oldest females in a herd, had recently passed away. So to me, it was, I mean, it really, Duncan, it just hit me in my heart and my face that there was something wrong here. And a kilometer or two down the road, there was a herd of elephants where you could see a little nudging, a little trunk slapping. And the obviously, the animals were not grieving. So that to me was powerful. I mean, I know a lot of your listeners have sadly lost companion animals, dogs or cats or other companion animals. And, you know, it just, you just see a radical change in the behavior of these animals that you can feel. And so to me, that was just as powerful as can be. You know, it wasn't a setup. I mean, I arrived in Samburu and we jumped in Land Rover and went out to watch the wild elephants there.
Sure.
But grief is a very powerful and very pervasive emotion among a lot of different animals. And, you know, people have seen what they might describe, what they would describe as grief in fishes and birds. And I saw a grief ceremony of magpies some years ago. I was riding my bicycle back into town with my friend Rod, and we came around a corner, and there was a corpse of a magpie in the road, and four or five magpies around the corpse, and sort of like looking at the corpse, touching it with their beak, and then one flew away, another flew away. Another flew away, and they all came back, and they put down some pine needles around the corpse. So I interpreted that as somewhat of a funeral ritual, and yeah. I was glad Rod was with me, because, you know, people would say, well, you know, you just freely
you saw something imaginary, or you're interpreting right. too much or whatever, yeah.
So Rod was incredulous. About a year later, I got a video on a flash drive from a woman in Canada who has seen the exact same thing. And shortly after that, and over the years, there's more and more reports in scientific literature about funeral services in birds. Mm. And that to me is revolutionary, because just to think of using the word funeral for a set of animal emotions 25 years ago would have been unheard of.
Yeah, well, it's a measure of how far the overall scientific thinking has traveled, right?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
And when I looked at this woman's video, it was exactly what I saw. And then there's been some reports of chaffinches, and you know, ravens and magpies are considered to be the most intelligent birds, maybe, you know, but eagles, but chaffinches and robins are intelligent too. So I got some emails from people seeing more common birds, if you will, show grief at the loss of a companion. So once again, you know, just wait before you start passing judgment.
Right.
I don't mean you, on
but
what
you leap to conclusions that you may have to revise quickly or semi-quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, some
of so we've got a couple of callers holding here, Dr. Becca, and I, we're nearing the end of our time, so I at least want to get one more of them into us and get a couple of questions before we run out of time. So hi, you're on Talking Animals, Dr. Mark Beckhoff.
Am I on?
Yeah, it's you. You're on Talking Animals.
I didn't even get introduced. I'm calling about play. I feel like scientists should really get down to a definition of play, because, you know, play can be have a little bit of a different definition for every scientists out there, but things about play, you know, just observing in our own yards and territories, we see squirrels running up and down the trees chasing each other. They're not mm-hmm. fighting. They're probably playing. And mm-hmm. things like, I have the little Cuban Anno lizards that live, you know, in our territory here in Central Florida and a lot of other places, they are seriously sentient. I mm-hmm. talk to them in a high, squeaky voice, and they'll stop running from me, you know, mm-hmm. out of fear, and turn around and look at me. I had one that would visit my windowsill just to harass my cat who wanted to get out and kill it.
Yep.
On a regular basis, she kept returning.
Yep.
So buzzards flying around when they're way, way up in the sky. I don't think they're hunting anymore at that point. Looking yep. for carcasses to come and feed on. I think they're really enjoying the air currents up there. This is a great show, Mark Beckoff. I'm so enjoying, and I'm going to look up all your books now. I know I've read some in the past, but thanks so much, WMNF, and I'm forgetting your name. Oh, Duncan and Mark Beckoff. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your call.
Well, thank you. Thank I mean, you there's no doubt that lizards are sentient beings, and I have no doubt that there's a form of you know, lizard play. And the question's a great one. Once again, it seems to be frivolous. They're doing things that when, you know, you think they should be doing other things. And so lizard play, why not? You know, lizard joy, why not? And I love what you just said about, you know, the teasing. I mean, this is why I do my work, and this is why Jane did her work, and lots of ethologists do their work, is the more you look, the more you see. It's not like we're inventing things. It's out there. And the door is open for doing much more broadly taxonomic work on animal emotions.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. We're rapidly nearing the end of our time. I'm going to try stupidly perhaps to squeeze in one more call, but thank you so much for yours.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, you're on Talking Animal, Dr. Mark Beckoff. We're literally almost at the end of our time, so I'm sorry you've been holding a long, long time, but if you could phrase it briefly and succinctly, we're just nearing the end of our time here.
Okay. My name is Basil. I'm in Largo. Besides observing tons of things that you're speaking about, I have one question. What do the deniers say that behavior is? I mean, it's quite obvious, you know. When my cat came up to me when I was out of medication, I was in pain, and was comforting me, how do you explain that?
Well, it's a great question, and I could go on, because what they're saying is the animals are just acting reflexively. They're acting as if they feel grief or joy or embarrassment. And we are way behind that, sir. Your animals are picking up how you feel. It could be visually, it could be your vocalizations, and most likely it's got something to do with odor. So the nice thing is that Love in Their Hearts and the second edition of my book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, shows that the number of naysayers has decreased. It's not quite zero, but it's really decreased, because they realize that we are not the only sentient, feeling, thinking beings. And yes. Cats are richly emotional. You know, some people used to say they're loners, blah, blah, blah. That's just a lot of BS. So thank you for that observation. And I wish I could answer all your questions, but
well,
really,
you're doing a good job as is.
Yeah, the tide is changing. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks again for your call and very astute observations. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you so
much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Getcha.
All right, Dr. Beckoff, sadly, we're sort of almost over our time now, but just want to say there's, of course, several other emotions that are covered in the book, and then there's, as you started to touch on, this guide to compassionate action. I wish we had more time to go into detail, but the key thing is that's all found in the newest book, Love in Their Hearts, A Celebration of Animal Emotions and a Guide to Compassionate Action by Mark Beckoff. That's MarkBeckoff, and that website is markbeckoff.com. So Dr. Beckoff, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals. I wish we could talk more, but we'll talk more certainly with, when one of those next books comes out. We'll get caught up then.
Right. And the last thing I'll say is that Jane Goodall, Roots and Shoots, go online and look it up, because it's a key organization for humane and compassionate education. And that the ideals of Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots are woven throughout Love in Their Hearts.
And so has a key outpost in Tampa, Florida, by the way, as well. So
yes, exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, well, thank you all. And if you have questions, email me. But, oh, I just... What a great show, Duncan. Thanks,
Dr. Beckoff. All right, take care. We look forward to the next book and the next conversation about that book.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. In a moment, I'll speak with Sarah Richardson from the James Museum, filling us in on their Menagerie at the Museum extravaganza coming up this Saturday, August 15th. Family-friendly event with lots of animals. We'll hear more on this when Sarah Richardson joins us in a moment here on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with, of course, a piece of animal-oriented comedy. This one is by Andy Woodall, doing the Hungry Penguin in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
I was in Oklahoma, and in Oklahoma, some people after the show, they said, hey, we work at the zoo, and if you'd like, we'll give you a behind-the-scenes tour of the zoo. And I said, yes, I would love a behind-the-scenes tour of the zoo. I've only seen the front of the scenes of the zoo up until now, and I'm not impressed. To be honest with you, the animals are cool, but they're not doing a lot of show stuff. I want to see some action. Get me behind the scenes. So I'm in the penguin exhibit, and they're very cute. And then the penguin lady, she says, watch out. I think that one's about to bite you. And I said, I wish he would. I wish a penguin would try to start something right now. I feel a little squirrely. I could use some action. And I don't think there's a lot of animals in the zoo I could win in a fight against. But all the flightless birds are on my list. I would ruin a penguin in a fight. I would definitely win. I did 3 years of JV soccer in high school. You don't think I could deliver a kick to a penguin that would make him wish his daddy never carried that pebble around for his mama? I would ruin a penguin. He's the exact colors of the ball that I am most familiar with. I would win. Plus, it'd be a cool story if I ever got to meet Batman. And I could say, I also got into it with a penguin and came out the better man. One of the many things we have in common, Bruce. And then the penguin lady, she holds up one gnarled, half-bitten-off index finger and says, I'm serious. They bite really hard. Oh my God, a penguin bit your finger off? Are you kidding me? Now I'm terrified of penguins. Now I have a penguin phobia. I can never watch Happy Feet again. Morgan Freeman's voice makes me nervous. I also have unlimited respect for this woman who had her finger bitten off and kept going back.
All right, that was Comedy Corner for today with Andy Woodall. Taking from his album, Beach Brain. Now it's time to speak with Sarah Richardson from the James Museum about their upcoming menagerie at the museum. Let's welcome Sarah Richardson to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So for those listening who may not, for one reason or another, be familiar with the James Museum, maybe you could just provide a brief overview.
Sure. Our full name is the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Art. We are an art museum that opened here in downtown St. Petersburg in 2018. We were founded by Tom and Mary James, who have been collecting art since they were dating in college, essentially. And they have a great love of both American Western art and anything to do with that history, and also the people that live there. But also Mary especially is a great lover of animals. So we have a permanent wildlife gallery, the Earth and Humanity Foundation Wildlife Gallery. And Menagerie is actually began as a way to celebrate that gallery and our love of animals.
Yeah, well, since we're kind of wandering onto that topic, let's tell us more about Menagerie at the museum.
So Menagerie at the Museum is one of our most popular annual events. It is our fourth year doing it this coming Saturday. And it is basically, it's an extravaganza for animal and environmental and conservation lovers. It's a way for families, but also visitors of all ages to have up close and personal experiences with live animals in a safe way that is both safe for visitors and for the animals. It's our way of celebrating not only our wildlife gallery, but also the amazing work that so many organizations in the Tampa Bay area do to help protect our environment and also help animals. We have lots of local organizations come every year, many of whom are repeats, like the Boyd Hill Nature Preserve and Pet Pal Animal Shelter and Tampa Bay Watch Discovery Center, while also making room for new organizations.
That's great. It sounds like it's going to be a blast. And also, I think part of that is the exhibit that's currently on display there about wolves that we highlighted early May when Ronan Donovan was first about to open that exhibit. So that's an extension, I guess, of Menagerie at the Museum, if I understand this correctly.
Yes, it's always a joy when we have a special exhibition on at the same time as Menagerie that is about wildlife. And as you said, you interviewed Ronan Donovan, who is a National Geographic explorer and photographer. He went out and photographed two different groups of wolves, both in Yellowstone and then also the Canadian Arctic, and studied them. And in the case of the Canadian Arctic, wolves got to be really close to them because they're not used to human interaction and therefore don't fear humans the same way that the Yellowstone wolves, who are very used to human interference, are.
So it was kind of a cultural study, you know, in a sense,
exactly.
of these wolves, as well as just breathtaking photography.
Oh, it's beautiful. We've had a great reception to it. It's been very popular, especially with photography enthusiasts. And I mean, did you know that kids love wolves?
Well, I'm not wolves. Surprised. Yeah, I'm far past kidhood, and I love wolves too, especially depicted the way that Rona has in that collection.
Oh, absolutely.
So
admission to Menagerie gets you access to our entire museum. It gets you those experiences with the animals and their organizations that are here and art making, and it gets you access to the special exhibition, and it's just $5 for the whole day.
So that's great. And so people just go search for the James Museum website, I guess, to pursue tickets?
Yes. We did sell out yesterday online, but there's always a chance that as we get closer to the event, people might return their tickets and they'll be released online. So I would check our website sporadically at thejamesmuseum.org/events. But we will also have a limited number of walk-up tickets available every half hour.
Okay, so you're not out of luck.
Not entirely, no. No, but it is our most popular event. We've sold out every single year.
Wow, that's great. Well, it sounds like with good reason. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Sarah, and filling us in on that and some of the other aspects of the James Museum as well. And again, it's the James Museum of Western and Wildlife Arts. So wildlife's right in the name, so that's why there's an emphasis. You can always count on having one or more exhibits devoted to animals or wildlife. So thanks again for joining us today on Talking Animals, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for having me, Duncan.
Thank you. Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back into the music program with Sam Ball holding forth from 1 to 3. And I'm not sure who's filling in for Nancy C today, but someone stellar is going to be in for Nancy, I'm sure, on the traffic jam from 3 to 6. And more great programming on WNF at 88.5 FM. So I invite you to visit TalkAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. Apple Podcasts are there too. And there are also links to our social media pages and other cool information. That's TalkingAnimals.net. This is Talking Animals on WNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Stay tuned for more great programming here on WNF Tampa. Thanks.